So welcome, Dee. Thank you so much for being part of this virtual summit on Coaching for Social Impact. Really looking forward to talking to you again and understanding more about what you do. I thought let's start off with just going straight into who are you, who are you as a coach, and what brought you to this interview today? Like, you know, what's the background?
Great. Thank you, Nick. And thanks for having me on this Social Impact Conference. My name's Dee. As you can probably tell from my accent, I'm from Ireland originally. And I've been living in London for the last 10 years or so. I trained as a coach with Animus about 2 years ago now. And who am I as a coach? Got such an interesting way to frame the question. Well, I think I bring to my work and life more broadly a kind of a sense of those basics around coaching. How do you create the space for non-judgment and for people to be seen and heard? And then I think I also kind of have that mantra of people being resourceful, whole, and creative, always in the back of my mind, as it was always in the front of my notebook when I was training Animus.
That's great. So you've got that as your sort of backdrop, if you like, to who you are as a coach. And then tell me about the project you're involved in and how you as a coach became part of that. Like, what's the connection?
Yeah, super interesting. So I work for a charity called Blueprint for Better Business. And we exist to help create a better connection between business and society so that businesses see themselves as part of society, not apart from it. And we do that by challenging core assumptions around the purpose of business and what motivates people. So for me, I guess I worked in business for a long time. I started to ask some kind of pretty big fundamental questions about what is the role of business in society. Through my work and also, yeah, was just starting to get more interested in what motivated me really in the first place and how conditions around us can create a sense of what ought and should motivate us rather than actually what is intrinsic motivation. So they were questions I was kind of pondering for a while anyway. I was also getting increasingly worried about, you know, all the externalities that happen through the short-term pursuit of profit. So I also started to like study a little bit more about economics, try to understand what the impact of the financial crash was, what led to it, what was the consequences, a little bit more around some of the environmental impacts that we're experiencing and climate change. So I started to like find, you know, myself really keen and curious around all of these things. I was interested in understanding what my role could be. And through that, I trained as a coach. And then this role at Blueprint came up, which was looking for people who understood coaching so that they could take a coaching approach to their work, but also had a real keen interest in this area and this big topic about what the role of business is in society. So, yeah, so it's kind of, it wasn't necessarily a hugely intentional path. It was one more followed through a sense of curiosity for myself. And then also this role of business, because I'd always worked in business. So
one of the things I find with these interviews is as soon as somebody starts talking, I get all these kind of like a roadmap in my mind for all different sort of A roads and B roads and countryside roads that we can go down. And I'm curious by two things, and I'll just put them on the table and see where they take us. One is the importance of knowing who you are as a person and how that underpins your coaching. So for you, it was business and it was the bigger picture of how does business impact the world? And you got fascinated by economy and what caused the crash and environment, all this stuff. Like, you saw this big picture, but you saw coaching as a way to do that. And then the second thing is, let's just get clearer on the actual project itself. So I think let's get clearer on the project, but I'd love to also come back to that question around, you know, how does a coach utilize all that makes them who they are in order to do the kind of work that matters to them? But let's go to the project first. Tell us about it. What is it? So you said what it's called, but just give us a bit more, like, what is the nuts and bolts of that project?
Sure, yeah. So it's the charity is called Blueprint for Better Business. It came out of a conversation and discussions that were had after the financial crisis, in which people were beyond kind of some of the issues around the finance itself and the finance world and what caused that. But what were some of the more fundamental issues at play? And so they came up with two areas. One was the purpose of business. So for a number of years and decades, there had been an increasing focus on short-term profits and the implications of that. But also there was a question around people, where people felt a little bit disconnected by the work that they were doing. So they kind of saw this double disconnect. One, a disconnect between business and society, where in the pursuit of short-term profits, there's a whole load of externalities onto society. And then secondly, where people feel disconnected in many ways in the human heart. So what were these two kind of core issues? And is there a different way of thinking about these things? So what they then explored was, well, what is the purpose of business? And of course, this has been a conversation that's been going on for decades, if not centuries. What we find is it's kind of a kind of a shift that kind of moves from where we see a kind of a focus more on the short term to then, you know, one in which we're trying to understand, well, what is the result for broader stakeholders? So the way in which they framed it is that the purpose of business is to provide goods that are truly good and services that truly serve, and that profit is an outcome of a well-run business, not the reason it exists. So how do we start to gain a kind of momentum around that? But then also connected to it is, if you kind of scrape back a lot of the ways in which organizations think about people, and oftentimes, you know, one of the really interesting things is people aren't giving much consideration to that. They're basing it off these kind of large assumptions, which that, you know, if you look at economics 101, you've got the Homo economicus for anyone who's studied it. And it's a view of the person as being purely rational and self-interested, essentially. And so a lot of economics models are based on this very limited view of the person. Now, what we say is we're not denying that self-interest isn't important, but it's not the whole view. And actually, if you look at the ways in which organizations show up and their processes and their systems, they're often based on this very limited view of the person. And so people, you know, the motivations tend to be the carrot of status, power, and money. And so we also felt that that was contributing to this issue. And so if you reorientate a business around a purpose that is truly about delivering value for society, and then you think more broadly about people and what really motivates people, so yes, self-interest and, you know, security and all of those things that are important in a job, but also that we seek meaning and purpose, how can those two ideas come together? And how do we reorientate businesses to the long term around those two ideas? So that's kind of essentially the provocation that we offer business, and I can explain a little bit more about how we work now.
Yeah, let's do that. But before we do that, just give us a bit of context of who are the, what would you call them, clients, or the who's the end user of this?
So, I mean, to a certain extent, our philosophy can be applied to any size or organization. But given that we're a charity and we're here to try and seek a systems change, essentially. And we're a small charity, there's five of us. We feel like the biggest impact that we can have is through working with the largest companies in the UK. So we primarily focus on FTSE 100 companies.
Got it.
And we operate then more at the executive, so the senior executive team, CEO, and more increasingly boards as well.
Yeah, great. Okay. So I do want to look at how you work, but I've got a few questions first, if I may.
Please.
The first one is, obviously this is a summit about coaching for social impact, and your organization has started off with a philosophy and a belief system in mind that it wants to change the system of business and how that functions. Where does coaching, which is a sort of a non-knowing perspective, let's say, how does coaching fit in with that in your mind?
Yeah, so I think what we do is we take more of a coaching approach. We don't necessarily say we coach, because I do agree that, like, the whole idea of coaching is that you're not necessarily bringing in that perspective and it's in a not knowing space. But we still, it's really interesting that phrase, not knowing, because I still think we bring an element of that. So yes, we bring in a perspective, and we do tend to frame our conversations based on blueprints, framework and principles. But we still hold the space of not knowing. So we don't assume. So what we're trying to shift is the kind of mindset around purpose and people. But what we don't assume is what the answers are, or that there's even easy answers, or that there's a kind of a knowing solution to all of this. So what we try to create in our engagements, and we do different types of engagements, is to hold that space of, that not knowing, while also bringing in a kind of a view and a perspective based on blueprints, framework, and principles.
That actually makes a lot of sense, because actually now I think about it, coaching itself has some fundamental underpinning beliefs that support the very fact that it exists at all. You know, the idea that people are whole and capable, et cetera, is a belief system. And then you layer on the methodology. Okay, great. So talk to me about how you work then. So you have, here are your big organizations. There's you, five of you. Changing the world. So how does that happen? What's the process for getting you five into these big organizations and beginning to make a shift?
Absolutely. So I guess, first of all, is a recognition that there's a lot of other organizations in our space also trying to create change, because sometimes I do get overwhelmed and I think, God, how are we supposed to create this system shift? And then I recognize, you know, that there are other organizations, you know, be it B Corp or you know, private consultancies also trying to shift organizations in this way. So then it's about recognizing what our impact as five people can be within that. So I lead on the corporate engagement. And so I work with my boss primarily, Charles Wookie, who's the CEO of Blueprint. And we do a lot of just initial engagements with organizations, either through high profile events, dinners, to introduce Blueprint's philosophy. And then what often happens either through those events or actually a lot more now through introductions. So one CEO introducing us to another CEO. Is we then do a little bit of work one-on-one to explore at a deeper level what this could mean for the organization and what challenges are coming up. And then if we feel like there's a mutual intent to work together, we do what's called a social contract. So before I jump into social contract, I just want to say we actually take no money from business. So we're funded by charitable foundations that also want to see a system shift. So we don't take any money from business, which I guess gives us a sense of freedom in both what we say and how we work, and also just how we show up. And I can talk a little bit more about that. But within the social contract is three aspects to our work. So first of all is to provoke a different way of thinking. So that's where we introduce the Blueprint's perspective, our beliefs, you know, the whole mindset shift that we're talking about, to the executive board, the CEO, and then the board. And we try to create, in that, we try to really create space for people to be able to do the deeper thinking themselves. So I often use actually Nancy Klein's approach to creating thinking environments in this way. So we do that through kind of small group kind of sessions. And then the second part of our social contract is support and challenge. So my boss meets with the CEO on a regular basis every 6 to 8 weeks over a 2-year period. And that is just, again, to create that space for them to be able to ask questions, for Charles to be able to ask them questions about what's hard, what's difficult, how they can maybe use Blueprint's framework and thinking, be able to resolve some of the bigger, chunkier kind of questions that they might have. And then in parallel, I work with either a small group or one-on-one with some of the key change agents in the organization. So that can often be director of sustainability, director of strategy, director of HR, investor relations, those kind of people. We either do that one-on-one or we bring them together and we do kind of explorations around some of the key issues. But again, I take a coaching approach. I don't come in with the answers, just yes, root my questions and Blueprint's framework, but it's still very much creating that space, as I mentioned, of not knowing. And then the third section of the social contract is what we call stimulating action. And that's actually not through us telling them what to do, but creating forums for cross learning and pollination of kind of different ideas. So we run forums for CEOs in small groups of 3 or 4. In which we create a safe space for them to be able to discuss what's difficult, what they can learn from other organizations. And then I do the same with directors of sustainability. We've also run a series with HR directors last year. So this is just about us creating a space. It's all people in that room will have an understanding of Blueprint's framework and principles, but they can explore what's difficult, what's hard, what they can learn from one another. So that's super interesting, and sometimes take an action orientated approach to that. So all the coaching skills kind of come into that.
I can imagine. It actually sounds like a perfect coaching contract, from the sales pitch at the start, so to speak, where you're actually getting on the same page, to then the support and challenge, to the action orientations. It sounds like it's a great fit. You said earlier that you would talk about how you show up. Was there something specific around how you show up that's worth mentioning, or did you feel you've already covered that in what you've just discussed?
I think I've maybe already covered that in what I've just discussed, so
I was curious. Okay, so I'm interested to know how, because it's one thing getting the CEO to buy into this idea and then slowly filter it down, but how do you maintain, I mean, by the way, I haven't done this work, but I'm sort of guessing there must be a sort of a need to maintain the integrity of that work the further you go down the organization.
Yeah.
I'm curious, how do you manage that process of disseminating the change of philosophy?
Super interesting question. So let me see, how will I approach this? So first of all, I think it's easy with the way that we approach it, because we work at the senior level, to then think that the approach is top down. Yes, we work at a senior level because we think unless these questions are really being fundamentally asked, it's very hard to create the change. But that, to a certain extent, then is setting the container. If then, you know, the challenge that we bring in or the provocation we bring in around people, and actually everyone in an organization within the right environment can and have a desire to be purpose-led and create meaning in the work, whatever that may be. So then that challenges, to a certain extent, this top-down notion. So we're very, while we always kind of work at that level, when they start to go into understanding how can they bring this to life, we really try to challenge that kind of view of like the top-down. So one of the ways in which we kind of approach this is oftentimes the word embed is used. And now this is kind of looking at language, which you could say, you know, is it really worth the time and energy to look at a word? But sometimes it's interesting to look at a word to be able to question what assumptions and what kind of views are held within that word. So oftentimes people are like, okay, great, we want to be more purpose-led. How do we embed this? So the idea of embed, if you think about it, means that something is external that has to be brought in. And what we talk about a lot of times is what you're trying to do is scrape away all the layers that are stopping people from wanting to do the right thing, or wanting to be more purpose-led or create more meaning in their work. And it's really more about cultivating. So how do you cultivate the right environment? And part of that is about going out and engaging the workforce. And trying to move beyond this either top down or bottom up and to think about change in a more networked way.
Yeah, that makes sense. When you talk about engaging the workforce, is that you doing that, or is that how you help the organization start to do that?
Yeah, it's very much the organization. So we see ourselves as more that catalyst to be able to catalyze that change and then help to keep the high level framing of that challenge as they move through. But really it's about the organization. And this is why I think it's really connected with that, me creating those spaces of not knowing and recognizing that the person and then the organization has the creative ability within themselves to be able to do it.
Wow.
I think there's been over the last few decades this kind of sense of when things get really hard, we outsource the thinking to consultants. And then consultants kind of, I mean, this isn't always the case, but then consultants can then have a tendency to kind of say, and this is our manual for change, A to Z manual for becoming purpose-led. And I don't think that there's any A to Z manual for this. And it is really about people doing the deeper thinking themselves. And then from there, the ideas can emerge. So again, it's a little bit of that kind of coaching approach to asking the deeper challenging questions. And then the ideas can emerge from that.
Yeah, that's interesting. What are you noticing? Are some of the challenges in implementing that? Because I can imagine that I'm always kind of conscious of the NLP presupposition that the map is not the territory, and we can start out with an idea of what we want to create in the world, whether it's your organization or a coaching school or anything else. And you have this beautiful image of this thing you're going to create, but then it meets the real world, and you end up realizing the territory is different from the map. I'm curious. Where do you see the challenges, and where do you think, oh, that's a kind of a weird, perverse outcome I wasn't expecting, or whatever it might be that makes you think, oh, that's interesting. We need to change how we do that.
Good question. I think some of the things is, I think the desire to do this quickly. And I can understand it, in particular if people are very, you know, people are concerned about the state of the world that we're in and And I think it's just this balance between, for an action to be sustainable, you need to take time oftentimes. And so this isn't like a project that can be done in 2 years. It's really about changing the way in which you show up in the world. And so some of the organizations that are, you know, leading in this way have been doing it for 10 years and are still trying to challenge with, you know, the trade-offs and tensions. I think some of the other areas is, so the challenge around that we offer around purpose and profit, how you frame that, and around people, we create the space at the senior executive level, but then oftentimes they don't do it, you know, they don't create the space. They think, well, we've done the thinking, we don't need other people to do the thinking. So how do you create that space? And for people to be able to really understand this challenge between profit and purpose, I think sometimes that tension can sit in the middle of management. And oftentimes, again, kind of coming back to language, we hear the phrase of the frozen middle. And we were at an event one time that we hosted with HR directors. And the HR director said, when everyone was talking about this frozen middle, you know, we want to do this, but, you know, it's just frozen at the middle. And when the HR director said, well, who froze them? And I think sometimes that freeze can happen because some work has been done at a senior level, but then the tension around purpose and profit can sit in the middle. So that's also kind of something that we see happen in organizations. So I think treating it as a project, trying to look at it in the short term and trying to think that you can resolve it all really quickly. Not really acknowledging the tensions that becoming purpose-led can create more openly within the organization. And then really kind of those questions around people and shifting the processes and systems in which you think about people. So there's some of the challenges. And I'm kind of thinking back to your question around, I guess for me, it's about always staying in that space of curiosity. And in complex environments, which these large organizations are themselves, and then obviously when they meet the world as well outside, there is no right way. And so we often recommend taking a more experimental approach to things. And so by taking a more experimental approach to things, you can maintain that level of curiosity as to what's working, what's not, and adapt and change and be more agile. So yeah, it's just knowing and recognizing that there's no easy, quick solution, and to stay open to the challenges that are kind of coming in, and really ask and question what are the deeper assumptions that might be at play that are having an impact in terms of these outcomes.
It's interesting when you talk about experimental. And I don't know why, but what came to mind was personal construct theory of George Kelly, and the idea of a person as their own personal scientist. So instead of thinking this is what it is, it's more like, what if I tried this and what's the outcome? And so I guess a question that comes from that for me is, how are you measuring outcomes? And what's the, you know, when you're doing these experiments, how do you know the impact it might be having further down the road?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's something that we're constantly asking ourselves as well. So within the social contract, you know, as I said, we don't, you know, there's no money, no legals within that social contract. So by how I maybe explain it to you, it sounds like we're doing a lot of kind of the giving there. But actually, the other side of the social contract that I didn't mention was that, you know, a genuine intent for them to want to change, but then also for them to be able to share the learnings more openly with other organizations and help us create a movement of large organizations doing this well. So for me, it's hard to get these down into individual numbers, but it's to what extent you sense that that movement happening. And so some of the organizations that we're now working with are just more than happy to talk about, within the events that we organize, the challenges that they're having, and then what's working and what's not working. So for me, that's less hard numbers and more to do with a sense that you feel like you're creating this movement. But having said that, I mean, some of the organizations that we're working with have really made some huge changes in what they're doing. So whether that's like introducing minimum wage, but what's the phrase again? Gosh, you could tell I'm on holidays now. I've forgotten my living wage, sorry. Okay. So he's introducing living wage, making some really hard commitments around climate and environment, plastic. I'm just looking here at our principals to understand, you know, how they're showing up in terms of their customers and suppliers. So a lot of work being done around the supply chain. So there's a lot of work that I can say some of the organizations that we've worked with are doing. Is that all down to us? No, we can't necessarily claim that. But we do have kind of a lot of stories that we can tell around the various kind of work that we're doing.
It's funny, I was thinking yesterday about the, you know, one of my things for a long time in coaching has been, you have to believe in the intrinsic worth of it, because it doesn't, the results don't always show up, certainly during that coaching contract. You know, often you won't get, particularly if you're working existentially or in some way that's not about, you know, specific behaviors.
Yeah.
You kind of have to believe in the intrinsic worth that in years to come that has makes a difference. And it feels to me there's a sort of a parallel with that at a larger level. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's really interesting because we have this discussion, you know, when we're looking and seeking funding for our work. If we set too close KPIs around what we do, then we're driven more by pushing the organization into that action. And then what that then in turn happens is you're not shifting that mindset within the organization, that takes a lot longer. So of course, you know, we're here to try and create the change. You know, like the reason I'm into this work is because I am concerned about all these externalities and about how organizations treat people both inside and outside the organization. So that's what motivates me. But if we are motivated too much by the KPIs or extrinsic kind of numbers, then I think actually it's really easy for our work, which is much more about the intrinsic, to just maybe take the wrong turn.
yeah, it makes a lot of sense. It's almost like performance coaching versus gestalt coaching. You know, gestalt's all about emergence and what's going to come, whereas performance is let's set the KPI and aim for it.
Yeah.
One of the things I was, as you were talking earlier, the around the frozen middle, as you called it, which is a very interesting phrase. I was thinking about the concept that we get what we reward. And, you know, if we reward a certain behavior, then that's what we get more of. And if we don't pay attention to a certain behavior, we'll get less of it. And I'm just curious, to what extent are you noticing the reward structures, be that financial or something else, beginning to change within the organizations you're working for, such that those frozen middles will start to unfreeze a little?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is an area that I'm really interested in, is how, so, you know, through the coaching work and you do one-on-one coaching, you can really get a deeper, you know, you work with people, or at least I do, to really understand that intrinsic motivation. But how often do we spend time thinking about that? And how often do organizations spend time thinking about that and creating those environments? And, you know, I can only talk about from a personal experience that, like, I never really asked questions more deeply around what motivated me. And so what was motivating me in my previous work were what the organization thought was good. And it wasn't until, you know, I had one-on-one coaching myself that I really started to ask those questions of myself. So one of the things I'm really interested in is how cultures can create a sense of what is success, what is worth, and what motivates us, and then how rewards can underpin that. And I think some organizations, this is a huge kind of topic, right? And you can't shift something so quickly without further thinking about the organization. So how do you think about what is, how you're motivating people in an organization, and what, and exploring discussions about what might motivate them as well. So one of the organizations that we work with talk about the inner and the outer game. So they've been working a lot on both. But I think the reward thing's really interesting. So like some organizations might try to shift things around reward too quickly without necessarily looking at the broader cultural construct that's at play. And then they kind of come into some issues. So just a very simple one, just to kind of, it's not necessarily around pay, but for organizations, say, for example, have tried to change, I'm struggling now with the word, but expenses policies. So this is an example that some more leading kind of organizations started to change the way in which expenses where expense policies were implemented in an organization. So if you look at a lot of organizations, their expense policies are like pages and pages long about what not to do. And some leading organizations said, you know, we're just going to rip up the expense policy and just say, spend as if it's your own money. But that was within a culture that respected people's sense of freedom with responsibility. Other organizations try to adopt this, and then they get into these issues where people aren't necessarily taking the responsible approach. And that's because they haven't looked at the broader kind of cultural construct that's at play. And the same can be for pay and rewards as well. So one organization we're working with, a lot of organizations actually, when it came to COVID, that we work with did salary cuts at a senior executive level so as to minimize job redundancies around the organization and to protect those in particular more on the front line or that might have less job security in the long run. Now in some organizations where you know, there's been a strong culture around motivating people through reward, through status, and then they try to implement pay cuts at the senior level, all of a sudden people are like, no, because the organization had created this sense of success over the long term. And then you try to bring in a different approach and that's where tensions kind of sit. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It does. I was thinking actually as you were talking there around how fascinating it is that you make a small change, but if the bigger system doesn't change, it doesn't mean the small change gets the results you expect. So yes. if there's a culture of fear, let's say, then you might make a small change that assumes fear doesn't exist, but it does at a systemic level. It still exists.
Exactly.
And then that got me thinking, Dee, is that, oh, well, probably the kind of people, the kind of companies that subscribe to work with you almost self-filter. Let me just put my hypothesis too, but you can certainly challenge it. I was thinking, okay, so you've got these big cultures, they may have fear as an endemic kind of issue, but they try to, but probably that's not who you're getting to work with in the first place. So I'm curious, A, do you notice a sort of a self-filtering process where the kind of organizations you get by the very fact they choose to work with you are ready and are sort of similar? And corollary of that, how do you then get to the hard to reach organizations that aren't self-filtering to work with you? That's such a bad coaching question, but hopefully you get it.
Well, absolutely there's a self-filtering in the organizations we work with. I would say though that self-filtering is probably coming at the senior executive CEO level, so that then doesn't mean that the organization as a whole isn't kind of more ready. In particular, we work a lot with newly appointed CEOs, not exclusively, but it's certainly part of what we see as a, you know, the theory of change is a CEO coming into an organization often has about 18 months to be able to really kind of have a little bit of flex to be able to move the organization in a different direction. So it's a prime time to be able to work with them. So obviously there's an element of self-selecting to work with us, but it certainly doesn't mean that the organization as a whole is ready. And actually, oftentimes we did a session recently just briefing journalists on our work. And one of the journalists said, God, it sounds like you guys work a lot with repentant sinners. And and I think that is true, certainly, of some of the organizations that we work with. So we are, through that, I guess, we are reaching those organizations that maybe historically were hard to reach.
And going back to the sort of second part of my question, and you sort of touched on it there, but how do you begin to more thoroughly, given that this is a long-term project, not a short-term, how do you more thoroughly get to those parts that other charities can't reach, to use the Carlsberg, marketing phrase? Like, how do you begin to get to the organizations that are like, no, we're all about profit for shareholders?
Yeah.
If I can just interrupt. The risk is, of course, that you end up with a bunch of companies that really are socially responsible and another bunch who are just going like, yeah, Hardcore, we're all for profit, and who win the day at some perverse level.
Yeah. It's a great question. And it's one, again, that like at each of our trustee meetings, we're constantly asking, you know, are we working with the right people? Is our theory of change right? I guess part of what we think about is how this is why the social contract, we ask that organizations help to kind of proliferate this way of thinking. So I think in part it is about not just changing those organizations, but how those organizations can be part of that movement. I think we're, and then there's the work as well at more the investor level that's happening. And that's not just through our work. We're engaged in some of those conversations, but again, there's other charities, other activist bodies that are working with the investor group. So, because those investors will be working across multiple organizations. So there's part of our work is about kind of saying, look, these are organizations that are becoming more purpose-led. And in the long run, it's not, they can, and I'd like to emphasize can, because it's not, you know, a done deal, also help create more sustainable profits. So it's about helping to create that movement. There's also some of the work that we do around identifying the organizations that we work with. So working with relatively new CEOs in play, or even actually before a CEO comes into the role, is key. But also working with a variety of sectors. Because if we only work at one sector, then we're only creating change within that sector. So we do try to work, you know, whether it's in the B2B, whether it's in, you know, extractive industries, consumer industries. So we are trying to work with a number of different organizations to be able to, you know, create this movement. But this is where I also think we're not the only ones in the system. And I think this is where also the power of activism can come into play as well, and the pressure that they put into the system. So yeah, not an easy answer. And as I said, you know, there's always a sense with our work that we keep some of these bigger questions constantly alive to challenge us as well.
Yeah. Well, thank you for answering it, because it can't be easy for you to just, you know, there's no blithe answer for stuff, is there? You mentioned investors there, and I'm guessing that the pension funds have a big part to play, because in a way they drive so much of what's expected from organizations. Yeah. Is there work going on there? Is that part of what you do, or is that where you talk about the partner charities that are trying to shape that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, my boss does a little bit more of the work around this area than I do, but it's very much just our voice being part of kind of those ongoing conversations in the investor world. I think, you know, there's some interesting things happening. I think Legal & General in the UK are doing some fantastic work in this area, really thinking long term. Because really, if you think about, you know, a lot of the ultimate shareholders are pension fund holders, insurance, like these have to take a long term approach. So, you know, there is a kind of an acknowledgement that the current way in which the system is operating around short term profit is actually not good for anyone. Mm.
Yeah, makes sense. You talked about activism. I'm curious to what extent your charity is a reflection of a much wider movement. And what is that movement, if you can sort of put words around that?
Oh, gosh.
Sorry.
What is that movement? I think it's just, for me, there's just an acknowledgement that the way in which business is currently operating is not working for everyone. And actually, it's probably not even working for shareholders in the long run either. So I think there is this broader acknowledgement that something has to change. Now, there is a whole spectrum of views as to how that change takes place and how quickly that change ought to take place. So I think, you know, for me, like some of the activism work, I see that as really helping to create the heat in the system. I think there's some really interesting things happening as well, though, now, both from, and this isn't an area I'm hugely clued up in, but from what I can see in terms of some of the activism organization recognizing that they have to work with and alongside business, while also creating that constant sense of heat, and also from organizations also working with and alongside activists group. So one of the things that we really have to be mindful of, in my view, is this kind of polarization that's happening. Business bad, everything to do with capitalism and money and profits bad. And on the other hand, you know, kind of thinking, business thinking, when all these activism groups are just stopping me wanting to be able to do good work or good business. And I think actually it's about creating more of an environment rather than a us versus them. It's about creating an environment in which we can acknowledge the role of both in creating the system change that is really required in this in the world that we're living in. Mm. And for me, that system change is about seeing, you know, a system that's optimized for profit and growth to one that's optimized for human well-being and a sustainable ecosystem. So how do we all within that kind of broad movement help to make that shift? I don't know if I really necessarily answered your question, but that's just some thoughts.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it answers the question, but it answers a question, and it's a really important one, which, you know, which is around how people work together to make these changes. Because it strikes me there could be a real pushback, almost like a complete counter wave of what's happening. And so, you know, it's, if this matters, how do we make it crystallize and become settled, rather than just become a moment in time that we look back in 50 years and say, huh, do you remember that time when we all got really worked up about social activism and good old back to profit nowadays? You know, so I think there's something really important about, well, if we do a them and us, we'll never get anywhere that settles.
Absolutely. And I think there's also a push around at the moment around stronger regulation. And I think we have to recognize the important role regulation can play, but it can't resolve the entire thing. If we regulate around all of this, we'll put organizations into straitjackets. And then I don't think that, you know, we have to get back, you know, as I said, some of our, the big deeper questions that we ask is, what is the purpose of business?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think this is a phrase from Bob Hewlett, who is one of the founders of Hewlett-Packard, who said, you know, for him, a company is when two people come together to do something that they can't do alone.
Mm.
For me, then the value is created by people coming together, and there's a greater sum in that value than the value they can create individually. So we have to kind of see that this is why organizations come together. We often, one of the shifts that we're trying to work with organizations when we start to get into the meat of our work is, when organizations are focused on profit and short-term profit, and they see that as their kind of North Star, and then you look at people as being motivated by money, status, and power, and you put those things together, what you get is a system of transactions. So you're just getting these transactional, and oftentimes then, and what's happened is value is extracted, not created. And so the shift then, if you see an organization's purpose is delivering value for society, of which profit is an outcome of that, and then you look at this more broader sense of what motivates people and relationships and the quality of relationships being important there, then you see an organization that is a series of relationships in which value is created through the quality of those relationships and through a basis of respect and dignity for people. So value is really created through those relationships rather than extracted from one party to the other. Then, you know, that's that bigger kind of shift that we're talking about. And so I think this is why oftentimes when we start to get into it, it's really interesting, no matter what challenge kind of comes up, I can really actually frame a lot of my questions back using some of the fundamental thoughts that's in this framework. So I can't remember what question you asked.
I don't either, but it's great.
You know, kind of emphasize this kind of, I guess a little bit of the regulation is that if we regulate around this, we can actually further and deepen that transactional nature of organizations rather than recognizing that really good businesses, of which, you know, you're a CEO of one, is created through the quality of relationships.
Yeah. Well, you certainly don't cultivate through regulation, do you?
No, you don't. Now, that is not to say that regulation doesn't have its part, but it's not the only solution. And I think one of the things that we're seeing at the moment is that organizations, well, they're not responding, so we need to regulate around them. And I personally don't believe that that's the only solution.
Yeah, interesting. Got a couple more questions before we close off, if I may. One of the things I was thinking about as you were talking there about the need for people to come together was, and I want to bring this back to coaching, is the idea that in a way you need to be able to take, not so much take the side of, but you need to be able to hold both sides of the view in mind, the activist and the organization, the employees and the employer, et cetera, and I was curious on to what extent your training as a coach enables you to hold that sort of morally neutral, if that's the right word, or certainly the emotionally neutral space that enables you to hold all that in mind. I'm just curious on the impact that had on you, if any.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I couldn't do this job if I hadn't trained as a coach. I think being able to hold, being confident and not having the answers has been for me. I think you're training oftentimes in organizations can be that you need to have the answer to everything. And so having that confidence that you don't always have the answer, or I don't have the answer, and the answer can be created in a space, has been hugely impactful in how I show up. Then I guess this has always been a little bit part of how I am, but not trying not to judge as much as possible. And it's been hugely important through the last few months as well, because people have been under incredible pressure, with COVID and lockdown and managing kids and everything, while also recognizing that the last few months and the next few months are critical in the system shift that we're looking for. I think there's so many tensions in my work. And it's one of those things, at the end of the day, sometimes you can just feel this real weight of responsibility on your shoulders. And I do, and I recognize that the people I work for do as well. But then I always have I do use a bit of humor, I think. It's just something natural that I bring in, and I often just have it with myself as well, you know? Mm. Like, I'm one person, I can't change the world. And actually, that desire is a very ego-centric view. I think just more broadly, being a coach has really helped me. I couldn't do this work if I hadn't had the training and the confidence that training has given me to be able to say, I don't have all the answers. And actually, sometimes being very open about that is really interesting, because you sense a sigh of relief within the entire room.
Right.
Because we've all, I think it's something about this paradox of confidence, and that we kind of lull ourselves into, or we dull our sense of anxiety by believing that this is the solution. And I think in most organizations, people recognize at some level that people don't have the answers. And actually being able to go into that organization sometimes, and, you know, when they ask me, so how do we do this? How do we become purpose-led? And I said, I don't have all the answers, and, you know, neither will you, but we will look to constantly, through a sense of curiosity, holding certain questions, be able to continue to explore that. So again, I'm not entirely sure every time you ask a question, but I'm not entirely sure I always answer. I'm not a very good client here. perspective, but yeah, I couldn't do the work I'm doing.
Yeah. No, you've answered it beautifully. What was coming to my mind was, it's funny, we often think of coaching as being about the tactical skills. You know, can we ask good questions which are open, and can we listen, and all these kind of things. But actually, there's also something which is about the philosophical mindset that sits behind it, that says, yes, I might not like the behaviors of this person, but I'm not going to judge them as a human being, because they're part of a system.
Yes.
That in some way shapes them to be that way, whether that's the CEO or the frozen person in the middle or whoever it is. It's like, I think, I'm guessing, being a coach enables you to hold those people with more compassion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's funny, I took a little bit of time out when I left my last job, and then before coming back to train as a coach, and I went traveling. And I met a lot of people traveling, backpacking and stuff, that had left the corporate world. And then it was like, in their minds, the corporate world was evil and full of evil people. I mean, I'm slightly exaggerating, but there was a sense, and I just, in me, was like, I've been in business, and I can totally recognize where my, and other people are there just trying their best oftentimes. But it is an element of, yes, don't get me wrong, I think we all have the responsibility as well within us. But also recognizing the system. And so I think that was actually when I recognized the response I was having when people would talk about these large organizations. And I think that actually was a key to me recognizing that where I wanted to go next in my career was to help these large organizations.
Yeah.
I remember feeling that real kind of desire and response when I heard those kind of phrases.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's been interesting, I think, over the last few years to see the extent to which there's been a real sort of separation of in the minds of the media, let's say, of what it is to be a CEO versus everyone else. And there's been a real high profile notion of the psychopath, the CEO. Like there's a really strange cultural desire to separate the echelons in a sense and to not recognize the humanity that exists throughout the organization. That's what I'm kind of finding curious from a cultural perspective, that, and going back to the them and us thing. So final question for you before we close off is just, well, I want to cycle right back to my opening question, which I said was like a country road, which was around I'm trying to think of my question, but it was essentially around how you have to know yourself first before you know how you can apply coaching to the world. In other words, Yes, coaching is a set of tools and we can think, I'm going to be a coach. But what is the underneath part of that? That's who you are. And I'm just wondering if you could talk around how you found yourself as a coach that led to this being the way you took it. Does that make sense as a question?
Could you clarify it?
Yeah, I will clarify it because I know it's a bit of a nebulous question. I think, so here's my provocation, to use your word. So I think a lot of coaches, they think they need to leave themselves behind when they become a coach. Whereas what it sounded like to me is you embraced who you were. You researched organizational change. You researched the cause of collapse, you know, the crash. You researched the environmental movement and you researched economy. You embraced your fascinations and your interests and all the things that made you who you were. And then you layered coaching on top of that.
Yes.
Rather than saying, I'm going to leave myself behind and become a coach in some weird disconnected sense. And I'm just wondering if you might speak to how you made coaching part of who you are rather than you became a part of coaching.
It's so interesting. I think why I struggle a little bit with this question is I could never leave myself behind that. Not even something that I can do. And I very much bring a sense of who I am to my work, which is, you know, that trying to be non-judgmental, compassionate, but also that sense of humor every now and again, which I think is important. I think this question of knowing yourself, for me, that's just a constant in, you know, in everything. So I have a coach. I'm part of a supervision group. You know, who I was last year, yesterday, today, tomorrow, like that's just a constant evolution. And then work becomes, in some ways, both through my work at Blueprint and my one-on-one work with coaching, also throws up loads of stuff that I can constantly learn from, and then vice versa. So I think I've just always had an element of a growth mindset, both about myself, but then also, like, I'm, you know, as I said, I've researched some of this area, but I still, you know, I have a long way to go in understanding, well, long way to go. There'll never be an end point in understanding, say, for example, the investor world. So that's, for me, an area I want to increase my understanding in. And also in the tech space, for me, is quite an interesting area. So, I don't really know how to answer the question, because I would never see myself as, yes, it's training to be a coach has hugely influenced me, but it hasn't separated me. It's actually integrated, if anything.
Yeah, well, that's beautiful. Yeah. You have answered it. And it was a really terrible question, I'm sure. It was more something that's evolved over time. I think something I noticed is how many coaches feel like they need to leave their former life behind. It's almost like coaching is an antidote to who they were. Whereas it feels to me like, how do you, you know, going back to Steve Jobs' quote around, you know, seeing the breadcrumbs of your life, it's like, how do you pick up the breadcrumbs that mattered and leave the little rocks that didn't matter, you know, behind? So that was kind of what was in my mind, but I didn't phrase it very well. thank you so much, Dee, for sharing all of this. If somebody's interested in just finding out about it, is there a place they can go and just learn about what you're doing?
Absolutely, yeah. So we have a website, so just Google A Blueprint for Better Business. There are some resources. We're actually in the middle of updating the website, and we're creating a learning portal as part of that. So this is where we'll capture all of our learnings that we've had through the social contract, and you'll be able to log in and learn from it. It'll be free for anyone to access. That one of the audience that we target as part of that is coaches and consultants. So we'll be launching that in the next few months, but lots of resources Video interviews about exploring our work is up on our website. Also, I would like to point people to our framework and principles. This is a slightly tattered copy of it because I bring it everywhere, even on holidays. And this is the foundational document of our organization. So the key thinking is there. But also really important to this group is we have a network of coaches and consultants. And that is, again, this is just about proliferating our thinking, our philosophy, and also our learnings, and also capturing learnings from other coaches and consultants. We don't pay. We used to meet twice a year in person. We're now potentially changing more to regular online, given everything. But please, yeah, look on the website. There should be information on the Coaches and Consultants Network. You can message me either on LinkedIn, or some of you will be connected with me on Facebook via the Animus Lounge. And yeah, happy to share more and how, you know, some of our work as well with coaches and consultants, which isn't directly the work that I do, but my colleague does some work in that area.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you so much. Dee, absolute pleasure talking to you again.
Yes, lovely to chat as well. And great, lots of really good questions, which I should probably go away and think of a little bit. That's you know, the key to a good question, right?
So. Absolutely. Thanks so much, Dee.
All right, brilliant. Thank you, Nick.
Bye.